WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 17th, 2026. I'm Rob Jerislein, and I'm going to be with you for the next hour talking about the Minnesota outdoor scene. Hope everybody enjoyed the first full week of open water walleye and pike fishing. I think windy has mostly been the theme, right? A lot of folks got blown off the water on opening weekend, and that wind kind of held up most of this past week. Finally warming up here, what, Friday and into the weekend. I think yesterday was a perfect day for walleye fishing. More weather blowing through today. And, you know, more discombobulated weather coming up here over the next week going into Memorial Day weekend. So, you know, if you're looking for consistent weather, which is what anglers like, correct? They don't like a lot of fronts coming through. Maybe not your perfect weather, but I tell you, if you just like being outside, it doesn't get much better than this. I tell you, one thing that's probably popping as we speak, we finally got some moisture and some warmer temperatures in May. That means morels. I grew up picking morels all across the upper Midwest. There's probably a lot of folks out there listening who have picked their fair share of those tasty mushrooms. I have never had a problem identifying morels, so that's the one mushroom that I can go out and feel pretty confident I'm picking the right ones and I'm not worrying about poisoning anybody. You got to be careful with mushrooms. You pick the wrong ones and eat the wrong ones, they just kill you. They destroy your liver in a matter of days, and you got to have a liver. So if you don't know what you're doing with mushroom picking, I encourage you to go out with someone who knows what they're doing. They're challenging to find. It seems like this may be a little harder, and I think part of the reason is we associate them with dead elms, you know, finding them around dead American elms. And there aren't a lot of elms left, right? Dutch elm disease killed them all when I was younger in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. So there were a lot of dead elms, and then there were a lot of morel mushrooms around those stumps and those dying trees. Folks out there listening are like, ah, Rob, we know where to find them. You're just missing out. But my point overall is, should be absolute prime time for morel picking right now that we got a little moisture on top of this heat. I knew an old timer who told me the best time to find morels was when the elm leaves were the size of a mouse's ear. Well, A, there's not a lot of elms left. And B, the ones that are out there, their leaves are probably quite a bit bigger than a mouse's ear, but it's just been so cool and dry that I don't think we had real good mushroom growing weather until just this past week. A couple of great guests coming at you here a little bit later. We're going to have Gord Ellis from Thunder Bay, Canada. We're going to talk to him about lake trout fishing. We spend so much time talking about walleyes and pike and bass that we forget that this part of the world's got some pretty great inland waters lake trout fishing. Unique species on some of our interior lakes, as well as Lake Superior, of course, but Boundary Waters lakes. And then you cross the border up into Ontario where Gord is, and there's a lot of great lake trout fishing in northwestern Ontario. So we're going to talk to him about that. Then for today, as well as next week, Stan Tequila will join us. Stan comes on to the broadcast about a half dozen times a year. We talk about non-game topics, and the migration's still going full steam, so there's lots to talk about there with Stan. The big news this past week was the legislature winding down. Of course, it's got to be done by midnight tonight. And I was watching very closely this past week the status of the legacy bill, the so-called Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations. This is a big deal if you're into the outdoors. These are the sales tax dollars that we dedicated via a constitutional amendment on election night 2008. It was a big deal when we did that. We dedicated those dollars. I think it's 3/8 of 1 cent goes into this dedicated funding account for 25 years. And that money gets divided a number of ways. But this year, just the Outdoor Heritage Fund amount, which goes into habitat programs around the state, that total equals $191 million. And what happens is we have this Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council that goes through a bunch of proposals, grant proposals. They recommend proposals to the legislature. And then just about every year, the legislature mostly rubber stamps it, says, yep, these are good proposals. Let's fund them with these dedicated dollars. These are not general sales tax dollars. And everybody's happy. 1 year back, 2012, 2013, we had a couple metro legislators who tried to revamp what the council had recommended. They added a couple, I think there was some AIS dollars and there was some metro money. And Governor Dayton vetoed it. He said, we're going to stick with what the council recommends or I'm going to veto it. So he did. And ever since then, the legislature has mostly played nice. Until this year, we had three amendments to the Outdoor Heritage Fund bill that threatened to absolutely drag it down to the point where, as of this past Thursday, we thought it might not pass. I wrote an action alert story for OutdoorNews.com. I put it in front of the paywall. We pushed it out on a lot of social media to make it clear to the public that this was at serious risk of not passing. As I wrote in my column a couple weeks ago, I may have even mentioned it here, and as I wrote in this piece on Thursday, I don't really even have a problem with the amendments the Republicans proposed, but it wasn't worth potentially losing the bill and not having access to these funds for at least until 2027. You got to get this money moving, get it in the ground. You got inflation that wants to eat away at these dollars. You got acquisition projects that could dry up if the money doesn't come through this summer. You had vendors who are expecting to be paid. So it's really important that you get this money done, you get it into the pipeline. Again, this is not general tax dollars. This money's already been spent and it's been dedicated toward these projects. And the sooner you get it in the ground, the sooner it can start working and doing good habitat work. Well, on Friday, we learned that they brokered a deal. There was some give and take. I'll probably be able to share all of the details on next week's broadcast after we know exactly what passes tonight and the governor signs into law. But it sounds like they brokered the deal over the Republicans had concern about how we're appointing the executive director of the Lasar Sams Outdoor Heritage Council and the term limits for the citizen members. And there was one project in northwestern Minnesota they had some concerns with. It sounds like we figured all that out. There was some more wheeling and dealing. I hope to talk more detail about that next week when we know exactly what passed. But I want to commend anyone who saw the action alert at OutdoorNews.com, as well as a number of conservation groups, the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Minnesota Wildlife Federation, issued action alerts to their members saying, please contact your legislators and insist that we get this done. If you followed up on that and you contacted your legislator, pat yourself on the back, because if this does indeed pass, it's because of the pressure we put on the state capitol late this past week. Okay, let's break and let's talk some lake trout fishing when we return with my friend Gord Ellis. This is WCCO Outdoors. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 17th. I'm Rob Jerislan. We're going to talk mostly lake trout fishing here in just a moment. Before we do that, I did get some recent numbers on how the turkey hunting season is going. Through the sea season, which would have ended, two Wednesdays ago now. This would have been through Wednesday, May 6th. State turkey hunters killed 11,695 birds compared to 13,480 at the same point in 2025. So harvest running a little bit lower than last year, which was a record year. If my remedial math skills are correct, and I've got a son who's a math teacher, so I don't know, that's down about 13% from 2025. So that's a double-digit number, but nonetheless, I suspect it'll still be a top five or at least top 10 turkey hunting season. You can't have record seasons every year. And I expect to have some more updated numbers for you again next Sunday. So we'll keep you posted. The weather's been improving. It's going to be down this year, but I bet we close the gap a little bit. I bet we won't be down 13% for the year. Okay, as promised, let's talk some fishing, specifically a species we don't talk enough about on this program, and that's lake trout. And then when we do talk lake trout, it's usually Lake Superior, but there are a lot of lakers on inland lakes in Minnesota and getting up into Ontario. And I know a guy who chases lake trout, especially across northwestern Ontario. He's a gentleman who's, I don't know if I ever remember having him on before, it's Mr. Gord Ellis. He is a big-time outdoors personality in Thunder Bay, Canada. He writes for Ontario Out of Doors. He also writes for a publication in the States called Northern Wilds. And his byline is in Outdoor News occasionally also. Gord, thanks a lot for joining me on the broadcast. Haven't talked to you in a while. Good to see you. You still got a little snow up there in Thunder Bay, huh?
We have a little bit, Robin. It's great to talk to you again. But yeah, we've had a really long winter here in the Great White North. And I can actually see I'm sitting.
I'll be darned. Well, and it's your walleye opener this weekend, the 16th, right?
Yeah, it is the walleye opener. And some of the lakes nearby Thunder Bay, especially to the north and northwest, there's still some ice on them. So it's going to be touch and go for some folks putting their boats in. And I expect some outfitters will probably have some issues, especially as you get way up north towards Red Lake and Air Falls and those areas, Nakina.
Well, this is a later ice out than normal, isn't it, for your area? I mean, I used to get up and do the ice out lake trout thing before our opener here in Minnesota, late April. So I actually think it's a good sign when things are running a little late with all the climate change we deal with. It's nice to see things a little colder than average once in a while.
What I've seen in the last probably decade is that our springs seem to be colder and draggier here, but our falls are unusually warm. and will stay warm right into October. And I mean, there was a time where in the first week of October, if you shot a moose up here, you could hang it up in a tree for a week. You cannot do that anymore. So it just seems to have shifted to warmer weather later, but it's been a cold spring.
Well, let's talk about lake trout. What are lake trout doing right now? These are, as you referred to them, as denizens of the deep. Most of the year, these guys are in the deepest, coldest water. We talk about all trout species being cold water animals, cold water fish. That certainly applies hardcore to lake trout, doesn't it?
Yeah. So lake trout, initially, well, in the wintertime, they can be just about anywhere because the water's cold, but they still will be deep often. So if you're, you know, fishing in the winter, you're often in 40 to 60 feet of water. As the ice goes out, the lakers will start to move shallow, but it takes a while. Like, they don't just rush up into the shallows. It's interesting, this part of the world, like, we can right now cast for brook trout really shallow in ice cold water, and you'll catch steelhead in ice cold water, but the lake trout aren't quite up yet. It takes a little while for them to nose up, but as it gets like into the mid 40s and pushing 50 Fahrenheit surface, then you see the lake trout slip up into the shallower stuff, and that's when you can get them, you know, in 10, 15, 20 feet of water, or even less sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes people hear shallows and they assume it's near shorelines.
Right.
When you're fishing these things, they may be way, way out in the middle of the lake, but they're just in that upper tier.
Right. They can be in the upper tier. They can also be on reefs. You know, some of the reefs will come up to 10 feet top on it, and they'll slip up on top of that. But there is a fair bit of shore fishing for lake trout in certain areas of northwestern Ontario, and I have certainly caught lots trolling along shoreline this time of year and into late May. Usually about a week, 10 days after ice out, it seems to be when the lake trout really start going. So we're just into it right now.
And you've got thousands of lakes across northwestern Ontario that have lake trout in them, right? There's all kinds of great opportunities to catch these fish. And there's some in northeastern Minnesota, too.
Yes.
These are a north country fish.
Yeah, well, the Boundary Waters has got some phenomenal lake trout fishing in it. And in northwest Ontario, Ontario actually, right across the board, we are blessed with good populations of lake trout and a lot of lakes, and some lakes that they can get exceptionally large in.
Do you see many guys going out and doing this? I went out 20 years ago. Just about every year, I'd make my way up into border country and do some ice out lake trout fishing. I haven't done it in a while. Is it popular? Are a lot of people chasing lakers this time of year?
I think it's less popular than it used to be, and I'm not quite sure why that is. Like, I can remember at one time up towards Sioux Lookout, Big Vermilion, Little Vermilion, and some of the lakes up in there, there would be just all sorts of people targeting spring lake trout. It still happens around Atikokan as well, which is just north of the Boundary Waters. There's lots of beautiful lakes there where people historically from Minnesota and other places would travel and fish lake trout. I don't think it's done as much now. I'm not sure if that's just a change in culture. I don't think it's necessarily because the fishing isn't any better, because what people fish for and how they fish for them changes over time. Mm-hmm. It's really, really interesting. And sometimes it doesn't, you know, there's no actual reason for it. It's just a change in culture and how people fish.
WCCO Outdoors chatting with Gord Ellis. He's out of Thunder Bay, Canada. We're talking about lake trout fishing in the spring. He's a guide as well as an outdoor scribe. So, Gord, let's say someone's listening, they want to try this. What are some tactics? What are some prime lures? How do you go about catching these lake trouts when they're in relatively shallow water right now? It differs than trying to catch them in August, I presume.
Yeah, generally in August, you're fishing deeper, often with downriggers or lead core. You might use a heavy weight. Big jigs is another way to do it, which is actually a fun way to catch lake trout. And you can catch some deep this time of year. Like, it's not unusual to go onto a bay, say on Lake Nipigon in late May, and find them in 40 feet of water. But they'll also potentially be in 10 feet of water. So it just depends on how you want to target them. And I'll often do what I call flatline trolling, which is without weight, weight of the spoon. Spoons like Williams Wobblers, Little Cleo's a classic. A lot of people like Daredevil, Eppinger Daredevil, just classic wobble spoons. You know, you're fishing 10, 15 feet of water. You might want to put a little, you know, ½ ounce rubber core or 1 ounce rubber core if you want to get it down a bit more. And you're just covering water that way. So that's, or another way to catch them is with a crankbait, like a shad wrap or They're very effective. Anything that's a minnow bait, if you're trolling, anything that looks like a minnow, because that's primarily what lake trout feed. They're primarily a piscivorous fish, so they'll like smelt and shiners and chubs and stuff like that. And then if you want to cast, you can still use spoons. Generally, you downsize it a bit, and they're more, classics, or like the little Clio or Castmaster. Or you can use jigs, which is a lot of fun. Love catching lake trout on jigs, like a 4-inch tube jig with a half-ounce head is a classic. Also like bucktail jigs, different styles of bucktails that look like a smelt or a shiner, so a white and silver bucktail, maybe a 3/8 ounce, half-ounce, and just work it. Swim it and just work it over the rocks, and they tend to hit very aggressively. Nice thing about lake trout is they are not shy about hitting.
We would troll, we'd make long S curves, slow S curves, going 2-3 miles an hour, trolling crankbaits or some of the spoons, and just trying to vary, the depth till you'd start to get some strikes. Now, of course, Gord, this was all in the era before forward facing sonar, and I'm curious if FSS has become a big deal up in Canada the way it has down here. That was the mystery of lake trout fishing, is where are these fish, just trying to find them. Has that dynamic changed with forward-facing sonar? I got to think suspended lake trout would put off a pretty good ping on a forward-facing sonar, and it would be pretty easy to find.
So I will be honest here and tell you, I don't have one on my boat. I'm not saying I won't get one, but at this point, I don't. Have I fished with people that have them? Absolutely. And you can certainly see lake trout suspended, as you can see any fish and target them. I seem to do well enough with the old school electronics and knowing the water. Again, I'm not saying that I won't ever get one, but I don't really normally have to go looking for lake trout too much. If you have certain areas that they're on reefs or drop-offs, if they're anywhere near your lure, you're going to find out generally pretty quickly.
I was chatting with someone who was walleye fishing later in the summer and using forward-facing sonar, and commented to me just like, wow, those lake trout really stand out.
I'm sure they do. Yeah, because there's just so much surface area there.
Right.
I think if you were casting, jigs and they were out suspended, that would pretty, just like in a muskie or anything else, you can pretty effectively target them. Yeah.
Let's talk about eating lake trout. This is a species that sometimes doesn't have the greatest culinary reputation. Generally, people who live in lake trout range push back on that and say, hey, you know how to flame, you know how to cook them right, you can't beat them in the pan.
I do eat lake trout, and we eat lake trout in this house. We don't eat them like every week for various reasons, but I tend to barbecue them. Yeah, you should fill it off the fat sections, and there's that brown layer that's between the skin and the flesh. You should take that off. That tends to be a little fishy. But I like lake trout. It's a flavor. It's a, it's a trout. It's flavorful. Bigger ones I don't eat so much for as much reason as, they bioaccumulate things.
Sure.
They can live a long time. And so, if you catch a 15-pound lake trout, it's probably 15 years old or more, and it's eaten a whole lot of smelt and other stuff that have some mercury. And so if you're concerned about that kind of thing, I don't eat a bigger fish. But a 3-pounder, like in the winter, I fish Lake Superior quite a bit, just outside of Thunder Bay, and we'll keep a 2-3 pound lake trout, and it's delicious.
Probably a good rule of thumb. Yeah, just release those big ones, keep the smaller ones for the pan. And their flesh kind of between a whitefish and a salmon, wouldn't you say? Kind of that middle range orangish?
Yeah, and it's highly dependent on what they eat. Although I've caught lake trout that were stuffed with smelt, but the flesh was orange. So at some point they're eating other things. They're eating freshwater shrimp or crayfish, and that they're getting keratin in their flesh. But I would say they're probably a little closer to salmon than whitefish. Whitefish is one of my favorite eating fish.
Yeah,
I
agree.
We have a lot of them up here. That's, I think, close to number one. But lake trout are very edible.
Gord, thanks a lot for spending time with me. Good to catch up. Good to learn more about lake trout fishing. I learned some things from you here today. You're a guide also during the summer. If folks want to access your guide service, how can they find you?
They can find me at my website, gordellis.com. Pretty much booked up for this year, but 2027, I can be booked. And I do brook trout, lake trout, trophy pike, walleye, salmon, all sorts of good stuff.
Good. Well, I'm sure it's going to be a great year for you up there as soon as that ice goes away. Good luck with that.
Thank you, Rob. Great to talk to you.
as our buddy Gord Ellis, gordellis.com. If you're interested in learning more about what he's got cooking with his writing or his guiding, let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 17th. I'm Rob Gerisline. We're going to have Stan Tequila with us in just a moment. We're going to talk nature topics. Before I do that, there's a benefit to support a friend of mine that I wanted to mention, someone who has worked with me at Outdoor News on and off over the years. He's worked our sports show booth. His name is Tom Katt, K-A-T-T. I think folks, especially on the north side of the metro, know Tom as a longtime music promoter, and I think he did DJ and those sorts of things. Tom is dealing with throat cancer, and so friends and family of Tom are holding a benefit for him on Sunday, June 28th, so still more than a month out, 1 to 5 p.m. at the Hog's Breath Bar and Grill up in Little Canada. If you want to learn more, there is a GoFundMe page for Tom. Just search for Tom Katt on GoFundMe. Sending all the positive energy I can to Tom and his friends and family. Now, this week and next week, it's our friend Stan Tequila, naturesmart.com. He's the Backyard and Beyond columnist at Outdoor News, and it's truly a great time of year, isn't it, Stan? Migration still going. I mean, probably starting to wind down as we get into the heart of the nesting season, huh?
Yeah. So, hi, Rob. Good to see you again. And, we are like full bore. It's a little bit of everything's going on right now. So we've got things like the larger birds, like owls and eagles, who have already got young that are leaving the nest. And then we've got some things like geese and ducks, who are just starting to hatch right now. We got robins that are starting to lay eggs. And yet we still have so many more birds to migrate into the area. So all the warblers are just really getting going. And then so we've got a big, long – so it's that kind of – dynamic season that all sorts of things are happening all at once.
Stan, we were talking a little off air. Do you already have hummingbirds and orioles in the neighborhood?
Yes. They came in probably 5 days ago or 6 days ago or so, and they're doing well. In fact, just this morning I was trying to photograph some orioles, and I counted at least five male Baltimore orioles that I've got coming into my feeders. So, and this is an easy thing to attract. You can attract these birds. Even if you didn't have a feeder out before, if you put out a specific oriole-type feeder with some grape jelly in it, guaranteed you're going to get these orioles coming down because they'll spot it right away and they'll come right in with it. So it's well worth your time and effort to try to attract in orioles.
And both those species, they come from a long ways away, right?
Yeah, these are true neotropical migrants. So they're down in central, sometimes South America for the wintertime, and they make their way all the way back up here to the upper Midwest and for their breeding. And this is something that maybe a lot of people don't understand, is that they come here to nest. They do not nest when they're down south in the tropics in the wintertime. They come here, only here, to nest. That should be a kind of a little light bulb should be going off in your head right now. That's how important your habitat is in your yard and what you provide for them. And so these birds are looking for this. They come here, they nest, and then they, at the end of the season, they turn around and they head south again and they rest all winter long.
How far south do orioles go? If I'm down in Mexico or Costa Rica, I mean, how far south would I go to see an oriole in the winter?
As you know, Rob, I lead photo tours to Costa Rica in the wintertime, generally November and December and in March. And every time I'm in Costa Rica during those months, the orioles are there, you know, and it's really fun to see them because there they are. And yet knowing that, you know, they go way back up to where we're at in the summertime, it's kind of cool to see them there. By the way, when they're there, they call them their birds.
Sure.
And when they're here, we call them our birds, you know.
Right. So you see them in March, and like you say, they're already here by early May. Do you ever have anybody on your photo tour that say, hey, let's look for their nest when you're down in Costa Rica?
I guess I haven't had that, but that would be an assumption that somebody might make, that these birds are nesting there also. And I don't know why. It just seems like a basic thing to me, but if it's basic to me, it may not be basic to everybody else, in the fact that these birds are not nesting twice a year. I've tried to look to see, is there a species anywhere that migrates, nests, and then migrates again and nests? I've yet to find one. I mean, there may be. I mean, there's almost 11,000 species of birds. So, and 40% of those migrate. So there's a fair amount that, you know, that could be doing that, could be migrating. And I just don't know. I haven't checked all of them to see if that would be possible, but I highly doubt it.
You know, from a bird's perspective, there's a lot of energy that goes into developing eggs, right? So, you know, we might think, gosh, Costa Rica, this is great. Look at all this food. This is a great place to nest. And it's like, well, that bird's got to gear up for that biologically.
Yeah. And they've got a long way to go when they get there. So there's so much to talk about with this whole, this topic, because these birds, they have to be in the right breeding condition. They just can't, for lack of a better comparison compared to people. People can get pregnant at any time of year. Birds cannot. Their reproductive system is only functioning for a short period of time each year. In addition to that, even with birds, only the left ovary works in birds. Even though they have two, we don't know why the right ovary doesn't work. So it's just one of these oddball things.
Wow. I never knew that one, Stan. That's wild.
Yeah. And then in addition to that, when these birds migrate, so at the end of summer, let's just use the Baltimore Oriole, for example, again. At the end of summer, the reproductive organs in both the male and the female will dehisce. They will shrivel and cease to function at the end of the season.
Wow.
Yeah. But you think about it. They've got a 1,000-2,000 mile journey ahead of them.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, and you're not going to breed when you're down south. So why drag your junk around if you're not going to use it?
Well, there's but interesting thoughts, Dan. Yeah.
But that's how it works. And then all winter long, and then come towards spring, they have what's called recrudescence, where they will organs will start to kind of rehydrate again. And then that's during the migration process coming back up. And by the time they get here, the reproductive organs are working. Hormones are flowing. This is why they're not territorial in the wintertime too, because they don't need to defend a territory, because they're not trying to attract a mate, and they're not trying to, you know, defend an area for food, because there's a lot of food all around. So then only when those reproductive organs start to rehydrate and start working again, do they start to, become aggressive. And a lot of times, like, for example, I just mentioned this morning, I had 5 male orioles, all the feeders at the same time. You know why? That's because all their reproductive organs aren't fully going and their hormones aren't flowing yet. When the females show up, and they have, there's been quite a few females around now too, they will slowly move into that breeding condition. And when they do, then they become aggressive towards each other. They break up into territories, and then they maintain those territories. And that's kind of gets them going.
This is WCCO Outdoors. We're chatting with Stan Tequila from NatureSmart.com. Stan joins us here on WCCO Outdoors periodically. Back up here in Minnesota, we've got goslings on the ground already. Someone, I think, in the last couple of days of April said they'd seen some. And then I saw some goslings, just tiny little guys. I think it was on May 1st. But they'll put weight on quickly, won't they?
Oh, they'll grow very quickly. Yeah. And I saw a pair this morning that only had 3 goslings, but these goslings were really big. And I thought, well, geez, 3, that means they've probably lost 6 or 8 of them already. And, these little ones were not little anymore. So they probably hatched in the latter part of April. Over the weekend, I went to a seminar about Aldo Leopold, and they were talking about for those of who don't know Aldo Leopold, he's kind of like the father of conservation, and started in the 1920s and on up through the 1940s, and basically habitat restoration and how to so on and so forth. Rob, I'm sure you're familiar with Aldo Leopold and his Sand County Almanac book and all that.
Yeah, I've read it multiple times.
Yeah. So I was attending this seminar and they were talking about this, and he was a great record keeper, phenology of what day did the geese hatch, you know, like we're talking now, or what day did this goes. And he covers from most of the 20s, 30s and into the 1940s. And interestingly, his daughter then did the same exact thing in the same area through the 1970s, 80s and into the 90s. And
was it Nina Leopold Bradley, or the other daughter? I forget.
Yes.
The other. Estella, was that the other daughter?
I think it's Nina. And, and it took the data from father and the daughter, and they compared them against each other. And they're showing that on average, it's anywhere from 4 to 8 or 10 days that things are happening now. Flowers are blooming earlier. Birds are migrating earlier. Insects are out. Different, you know, and it was just an interesting thing to look at and compare general observations from the same area two different people, obviously, but over a big, long period of time, and to look at that and see this big change that we're seeing in the environment as things go along. And so we will continue to see more and more of these changes and more things like this evolving over time.
Well, and to be clear, this is climate change. This is because our winters are not as long, and we're having warmer summers, warmer springs, warmer falls.
Yeah. It's the whole, you know, it's one big thing. You know what I'm saying? It's one big, typical analogy is the spider web. You know, you pluck one strand in the web and it, you know, vibrates throughout the entire web. And that's exactly how this is. Everything is being changed or being affected, I should say, by the change of the climates.
Stan, one other nesting item. I know you had your great horned owl nesting platform out. How big of a brood did they pull off?
So, for those who don't know, I've got a pair of great horned owls have been nesting in my property for the last 5 years.
And it's in West Metro, right?
It's at my lake place. So it's a north kind of central Minnesota. And I had, last October decided to put a camera on that nest and live streamed it 24/7, started February 4th, and it went till May 6th or something like that, or 5th or something like that. And they laid three eggs, hatched all three of them. But the youngest one, we had a stretch of 4 or 5 days of cold, cold, wet weather, and the littlest one couldn't make it through that. So, but the other two did make it. We've named these birds because mm-hmm. we had such an amount of people watching, and everybody wanted to know, you know, and they were starting to make up names and things like that. So I said, well, let's just give them names. That way it's, you know, stays consistent. But Sage was the oldest of the hatchlings, and then Sky was the next one, and the two of them made it to the very end, and they fledged, meaning that they left the nest. And with great horned owls, as soon as they leave the nest, they're done. They don't come back. So they left, and the first one left one day, and about 2.5-3 days later, the second one left, and so which left us all literally empty nesters, and they were just gone. And everybody was like, "Oh my gosh, what happened? Where are they?" And all that. So I've been like wondering myself. Last night, I was out about 11 o'clock last night, and we have the big patch of woods, and I could hear both of the babies begging for food off into the woods. So I was like, oh, thank goodness that they've survived.
That's exactly
so far.
What they should be doing is begging for food from their parents, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And these babies will continue to beg food from their parents until August, September. I've seen them as far as late as October trying to do it. So the parents will feed them all summer long too.
Well, good. I'm going to thank you for the update. If folks want to, obviously they can't watch the platform now, but maybe next winter they can, right?
That's correct. So we'll start it up again next year. It's on YouTube. It's Nature Smart Media. And I do have a bunch of shorts there and things people can go and see.
Stan, thanks so much for joining me this week. You'll return with us on next week's broadcast.
All right. Sounds good. Talk to you then.
There's our buddy. Yeah, Stan Tequila. Check out what he's got cooking at naturesmart.com. Let's break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 17th. Rob Gerisline winding down our final segment of this week's broadcast. Countdown to Memorial Day weekend. Hope everybody has got great plans with friends and family, and also safe plans. Be careful out there on the water. The water's still cold. And as I mentioned last week, be careful of some of the critters on the landscape. I mentioned a story on this broadcast a week ago about the rabid beaver out in New Jersey. This week, I want to spend just a moment reminding folks, be safe around bears. We've just got black bears here in Minnesota. However, I believe there was just a fatality up in Canada as a result of a black bear attack. And of course, it's been all over the news, the bear attacks out in Yellowstone and Glacier National Park that occurred earlier this month. Glacier might be one of my top two or three favorite places on Earth. I really love Glacier National Park. It's a remarkable place. But there are a lot of grizzly bears running around those two important pieces of public lands, and their population is expanding a bit. I'm not one of those people that thinks these two attacks mean we immediately must start being more aggressive with bear management. I've seen some legislators out there saying that, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. I will say this, however, and I want to be respectful. The relatively young man killed out in Glacier, 33-year-old Anthony Polio, P-O-L-L-I-O, reading some of the news reports late this past week, they were suggesting that he very well may have deployed
bear spray in this attack that killed him. The latest report I saw is they know it was a bear attack. They know it was an animal attack. They're not positive it was a grizzly attack. It probably was. There have been 10 other fatal grizzly bear attacks in Glacier National Park going back to 1967. I don't think there have been a fatal one, though, in like 30 years, I believe is what I read. The most important takeaway, and I backpacked all the way across Glacier National Park, I believe in 1994. An important thing to remember is it's my understanding there has never been a bear attack, certainly not a fatal one,
on a group of four or more people.
If there's multiple people, bears and other aggressive animals generally move on. Even two or more is important. Now, this situation in Yellowstone, I guess it was four people, but two of them kind of got out ahead of the others, so they were kind of out in front, and this bear attacked them. Now, these two guys lived. But if you are in bear country, don't hike solo. Even if you have bear spray, even if you've got a gun with you, you're just asking for trouble. I want people to go out and enjoy our public lands. I don't want people to be afraid and frightened to go out and enjoy these incredible public assets we've got here in North America. But be careful. Be careful for your sake and be careful for the sake of wildlife.
So there is my public service announcement going into Memorial Day weekend. We'll be back with you here on this station in 7 days. I'm Rob Gerisline signing off for WCCO Outdoors.